This is Will Kennedy in the second session of two sessions on the World Council of Churches here at Holden Village. At the first session 2 days ago, I gave a rather lengthy introduction to the World Council. Most of you were not there, I believe. How many of you were not there 2 days ago? Well, I think rather than take 45 minutes again of a period of questions and answers, I'll just suggest that if you want a fuller kind of background, listen to that tape. It went pretty smoothly, not too many pauses and messing around, but I think today I'd like to give a much shorter introduction and then go straight into things. First of all, I've brought materials in a heavy suitcase all the way from London and then from New York and via Berkeley, so you can get some idea of the publications of the World Council. One of the problems of any international organization is communication. And so the World Council puts out a variety of pieces, and some of you who came in early have already been looking at them. One is called One World. It's a monthly popular magazine that goes around the world. It tries to give an overall view of the major things going on and so forth. So I'll pass this around. A second thing is Ecumenical Press Service. This is an official press release mechanism that goes out in French and German and English. And I get the English one to keep up with things that are going on. It comes by surface mail unless you're in the newspaper business when you want it air mail, but I get it about a month late in New York. But it brings more details and also some documentation, a page of summary of major things that are going on so that you can get information about things. One of the values of the international church networks, not just the World Council of Churches, but the Vatican and the denominational families and so forth, is that they furnish an alternate means of communication to the official diplomatic communication of the governments and of the international press services. Those have their own particular emphases and slants, and the church network brings in other kind of information. It often brings in information that's much closer to what's happening among people in different parts of the world rather than just the governments or the headline makers. So this is part of it, and you're welcome to look at some of these if you'd like just to glance at them and pass them on around. World Council puts out two journals that come out quarterly. This is the Ecumenical Review, which publishes major documents. It's sort of the official record of things that are usually already passed in some fashion and official. Pretty dry stuff sometimes, but an invaluable kind of record of theological discussions and so forth. The second one is International Review of Mission, which is put out by the Commission on World Mission and Evangelism. And this is the journal that reports the conversations that go on among all the world churches' mission agencies as they coordinate themselves through the World Council Commission. So if your church library gets more than just your Lutheran materials, then a subscription to these things would really provide a continuing source, particularly when they're controversial things or big things like the assembly in Vancouver. The secular press reports selected things, of course, and these materials give you a broader spread. In the library here is Christianity in Crisis, and this belongs to the library. I picked it up and brought it over here, so I need to get it back right afterward. But the best single article that I've seen on the World Council Assembly for Americans is this one by Betty Thompson, which describes in 4 or 5 pages the different things that are going to be going on in Vancouver in the next 3 weeks. So if you're interested in that, it'll be over in the reading room of the library in the next building. Now, let me say just a word. I'm Will Kennedy, and I teach at Union Theological Seminary in New York. As you can tell from my accent, I didn't grow up on the streets of New York. I grew up in South Carolina. I'm a Presbyterian, a minister, and am an educator. I've taught in seminaries, and I've worked in the Board of Education of our denomination, the Southern Presbyterian, which is now reunited with the United Presbyterian Church. That's where I got to know most of my Lutheran colleagues before I went over to Geneva. And working with the LCA people, Kent Gilbert and others, some of you may know them from the LCA offices in Philadelphia. When I was in the World Council of Churches as a staff member in the Office of Education for 6.5 years, which is where I got to know the World Council, I visited the ALC offices. Both of those churches are member churches, and I think they were founding members in 1948. So my contacts with the Lutheran churches have been through that ecumenical network, and I come therefore with high appreciation of the kind of collegial work that is done in the education work, which is the part of it I know particularly well. Now, the World Council of Churches was started in 1948 at the Amsterdam Assembly, the first assembly. It actually had been in preparation for 15 years before, but the war broke out in Europe and delayed its founding for 8 or 10 years. It went back to ecumenical gatherings earlier in the 20th century along tracks called Faith and Order and Life and Work. Now, what I put up here is a chart of the program and organization activities of the World Council. And I thought that might be a quick way just to run through this and identify these so that the questions you may raise can relate to all kinds of parts of the work of the World Council of Churches. This may be hard for you to see, but the member churches, there are now something like 303 of them. And all over the world, the only major churches that are not members are the Roman Catholic Church, the Southern Baptists, and a good many evangelical churches. Oh, by the way, while I think about it, the Roman Catholic Church is a part of the Christian Conference of the Caribbean Christian Conference. They're regional councils of churches and national council of churches. And the World Council of Churches maintains relationships with those regional councils, but it is a council of churches, so that its members are churches that are identified as communions or denominations in a particular country. The U.S. has the most member churches. 31, I think, of the churches in the U.S. are member churches of the World Council of Churches. Increasingly, in the last two decades, the newer churches of the third world, of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, what we knew when we were growing up as the mission fields, as those colonies became nations, their churches became independent churches. And so most of them are now members of the World Council of Churches. And that's responsible for a significant shift of emphasis and image. Originally, it was a North Atlantic-dominated World Council. It still breathes a European atmosphere when you work there, because most of the staff people underneath, the support staff people, are Swiss. It's hard to get work permits for secretaries from Africa or from Asia or even the United States. And as they're Swiss out of work, a very few compared with most of our countries, then they limit the number of work permits that can be given. It's freer at the executive level, and there are about 110 executive staff, people like me who are specialists in one of these areas or another. The American staff members number about 10 or 12. So the experience of being on that staff is an experience of being a token American, a token U.S. Christian, and a body of Christians from all over the world. The period I was there from 69 through 75 was not an easy time to represent the United States. We were asked questions continually about Vietnam, about the bombing in Cambodia, about Watergate. People who live outside our country and who see it as just a big, powerful nation acting like any big, powerful nation, sort of throwing its weight around, doing things that most Christians don't go wholeheartedly for, and those who feel the effects of those things badly in other parts of the world would keep asking the American delegates who came over and those of us who were on staff, if the churches are so strong in your country, why does your government do these things? So the experience of trying to interpret the difficulties of church relationships to government positions and so forth in our country, that long experience is a real tough kind of education that those of us who are Americans on the staff undergo. And it's partly out of that that I share with you and can give you kind of background on how things work. With a combination of pain and commitment, the struggle is intense to try to bring together people with all those different languages. Every official meeting has documents in four or five languages. French and German and Spanish are the official ones, in addition to English. The Russians provide for Russian interpretation, so that you have to give up the colloquialisms, the things that we prize most about our speech. I struggle to maintain the purity of my accent, but I had to give up a whole lot of the jokes and the things that are much more culturally bound. And I ended up having to speak or try to speak a kind of basic English that was understandable by people for whom English was a second or third or fourth language. And the few times I was in meetings without simultaneous interpretation that were in French or particularly in German, then I realized how much burden we put on the non-English speaking people. And that's another one of the restless edges. Most of the Christians in the world who are not English mother tongue, who are in on those meetings, have a very difficult time sensing the nuances and getting into it. They had a kind of rule of thumb that I thought was pretty good, that anybody who spoke in a meeting who had to speak in a tongue that was not their mother tongue, that is, not one of the European languages, got twice as much time. If the limit was 5 minutes, then a person who was an African who spoke a tribal language from Africa has a mother tongue and was struggling to speak in French or English, got twice as much time to speak. So the communication problem within was always a problem. This is a regional conference paper that I wanted to pass around. This happens to be the Christian Conference of Asia, and you'll get some idea of how a major regional conference tries to communicate its news as well as at the world level. Now, the member churches meet once every 7, or this time it's 8 years. This is the sixth assembly since 1948. And there'll be about 800 or 900 delegates in Vancouver. Most of them will be males. Most of them will be clergy. Because when you ask the churches to send delegates, these 303 churches, they tend to send the leaders that are in their churches, and they tend to be ordained males. For the last 10 or 15 years, the World Council has made a very serious effort, pushed by many of the American churches, to include more young people, more lay people, more women. And this assembly will have a higher proportion of women among the delegates than any previous assembly. We'll have a higher number of lay people, and that's not easy to achieve. One of the results is that the old-timers that I've talked to about it are nervous because this assembly has more people that have not been at previous assemblies than any other. So there are fewer people involved who will have a running start at how to deal with the complexities and come out with priorities for the World Council for the next 7 years. So it's going to be a very interesting assembly to watch because in ways it's the most unpredictable assembly of all six. The preparation has been good, the documentary presentation has been better than ever before, and they have had a series of visits around to the member churches for the last couple of years. Some of you may have been in on some of those ecumenical team visits that have gone to different parts of our country as to all the other countries. So that the preparation has been better, but the predictability is partly because they're reading the varieties of the churches more carefully the predictability is less sure. So the assembly sets the agenda for the next 7 years. It elects a central committee of about 130 or 140 members. That means that every member church does not have a member of the central committee. It's sort of distributed according to the number of people in the churches, the number of members in the different churches. And because the U.S. churches have large membership and have representatives in the assembly, we always have a good number of people on the central committee. The Russian Orthodox, well, the Orthodox churches of the world, which came into the World Council in 1961, are also large churches in the Middle East, in Greece, in the Soviet Union, in Bulgaria, in Egypt, in Ethiopia. All those churches have large membership too. And so there will be a large delegation of Orthodox people, including more women than they sent to Nairobi 8 years ago. The Central Committee meets every 18 months or so in between assemblies and tries to monitor things. It approves staff and priorities and big meetings. They elect an executive committee of, 20 that meets every 6 months or so to try to keep, through that representative system, a governing from the churches of the whole thing. Inside, in terms of staff, the General Secretariat is made up of the General Secretary, who at the moment is Philip Potter. He'll be retiring in a couple of years, and so one of the big agenda items for the next period is the election of a successor. The first General Secretary was Vissetoft, a Dutch theologian who really did the preparatory work for the 1948 Assembly and was the General Secretary for many years. He's quite old now. They had an 80th birthday party for him. I think he will probably not be at Vancouver, from the latest word I heard, although he'll be with it in spirit from his home in Geneva. The second General Secretary was Eugene Carson Blake. Blake had been chairman of the Finance Committee, and in what's interpreted sometimes as a sort of transition from the long Vissetoft reign, Blake came in and sort of brought a pragmatic American managerial style to it. I went over there in 69 when Blake was the General Secretary. It was in his period that they faced the first severe financial crunch because of the fluctuation of the international money market. When I went in 69, a dollar contribution from a member church over here brought 4.28 francs. This year it brings 1.9. And there's been a similar decline in the German exchange rate. So that the big contributions bring in less workable money than they did 10 years ago. And it's very difficult for an organization to adjust that proportion of cutting a half, cutting a fourth or a third out of its budget. Our churches in the U.S. have increased their giving, but the net effect has not been an increase because of the decline of the dollar against the Swiss franc. At any rate, the General Secretariat has to worry about that, and there's a Finance and Central Services. It deals with everything from Xeroxing to building and the budget and all the exchange business around the world and all those different currencies. The library, which is an increasingly valuable collection of ecumenical activity, work. Some 300 doctors' dissertations on ecumenical themes are there in microfilm, that sort of thing. Communication is the part of it that publishes all the books, sells the books, does the magazines, tries to keep up with the press of the world. Bassi is a chateau outside Geneva where the Ecumenical Institute is located. It's part of the Graduate School of the University of Geneva, and its major program is a graduate theological program, mostly for pastors who are from all over the world. They have a class every year from about October through January, which is the first term of the academic year in Switzerland, of about 45 or 50 students. Most of them come from the third world. They're scholarship students. The last time I was with them over there in 75 for a session with them on the work, our work in the World Council, there were 22 different mother tongues in the 45 people in that class. So it's a very interesting ecumenical kind of experience. Some of you may have chances to go there, or may have been there for week-long or two-week-long conferences, and that material, those are advertised through the publicity. Now, the major work goes on in three program units, and these are the things that do the work with the member churches. The first one is the program unit one on faith and witness. It includes faith and order, which has a new statement on baptism, Eucharist, and ministry that they're very excited about. They've been working on this thing for 20 years, including the Catholics and the Baptists, pretty much the most representative theological think group of the world churches. And they've come up with a statement that says, basically, in baptism, in the Eucharist, and in the nature of ministry, ordination, there are no fundamental theological differences among the churches of the world. Now, there are a whole lot of practical differences, as you know. But this statement has now been sent out to the churches for their reaction. And in the slow way these documents work, churches will probably refine it. But the hope is that within 10 years or so, there will be mutual ministry recognition, there'll be mutual baptism recognition, and the Eucharist will be moving toward wide openness between anybody who is Christian. Yes.
As I understand, the Catholic and the Baptist do not belong to the WCC.
That's right.
But they come in and out as interests.
That's right. And particularly in faith and order, mm-hmm. which is sort of the theologians' club. and you can't imagine 200 theologians in Lima, Peru, shouting with happiness and singing the doxology as enthusiastic people over the final approval of a document they've been working on. But that's one of the things that really goes wider than just the membership. Yes. Second one is world mission and evangelism. That came out of what was known as the Old World Missionary Council, and it's the mission agencies of all the churches. And originally they were the ones that got together to divide up the mission land so they wouldn't stumble over each other out there trying to convert people. And it now deals with the serious questions of what's the nature of the mission of the church in the world today. Third one is church and society. It has dealt in ways of study programs. Its major work in the last period has been the big conference at MIT that you read about 2 or 3 years ago on faith, science, and the future. And it brought together from all over the world scientists, most of whom were Christians, theologians, to talk about things like genetic engineering, about nuclear energy, and the other major technological scientific advances that are raising deep and new kinds of questions for Christian ethical response. The fourth one is dialogue with people in groups of other faiths and ideologies. This one was started at Uppsala in 1968, shortly after. It's a program that tries to set up conversations, dialogue, with the Buddhists and the Hindus and the Muslims and the Jews, and with people who are ideological in a kind of quasi-religious way, like in Eastern Europe with the Marxists and so forth. And it's a program that grew out of the World Mission and Evangelism and has had some exciting things happen as the great religious families of the world all share an equal kind of value to human life. And so increasingly, as the threats to human survival become more dangerous in the world today, these great faith traditions find themselves able to talk to each other about some of those things, and that dialogue program is the instrument for that sort of discussion. Program Unit 2 on Justice and Service includes the church's participation in development. It's the church's attempt to deal with the so-called developing world, or undeveloped world, or underdeveloping world. What about the whole business of world trade? How does that affect the churches? What about the churches in these new nations which have something to say morally and ethically about the aid mechanisms and what they often call the process of underdeveloping those countries because of the way international trade and the International Monetary Fund and so forth are carried on? the new international economic order. The church's participation in that all around the world finds a sort of center for that conversation in this commission. The second one is international affairs. That one predates the World Council. Since back before the Second World War, the churches got together and began to deal with international affairs. And this commission includes church people, Christians from all over the world who are diplomatic people. The chairperson of that is a friend of ours named Ole Dahlén. He, for years, has been the ambassador from Sweden to the United Nations and is a very competent diplomat. He's just retiring. But for two terms, he's been chairing that commission. It has two or three staff people. When we were there, the staff person was a Uruguayan lawyer. He was succeeded by the present leader of that staff group, who is an Indian Christian named Nainan Koshy. They work with the United Nations, with all kinds of activities diplomatically, and as you may know, in the United Nations and UNESCO setup, parallel to those government organizations is a large number of non-government organizations, so-called NGOs. And the World Council of Churches, Commission on International Affairs, and the Vatican's people. The Vatican is a member state, of course, since it's a nation as well as a church. And so, but the NGO activities of many groups around the world, the Christian symbol in the middle of that is usually channeled and coordinated through this part of the World Council. The program to combat racism was started after the Uppsala Assembly. Martin Luther King Jr. was supposed to preach at that assembly in 1968, and he was killed two or three months ahead of it. Out of that came a program which has worked to combat racism, not just to try to be calm about it and educate, but to fight it. And they've identified the major kind of racism as that embedded in the white racism of institutional structures of the white world, and that's us. So that its target has been Western Europe and the United States and Canada mainly, because the institutions of the world that seem to perpetuate racism and are very powerful in doing so, one way or another, seem to go back to the racism in our part of the world. So that's been the program that's gotten most of the flack. They set up a special fund to deal with liberation movements that were really combating racism, and I'll be glad to talk more about that in detail if you'd like. But those grants are not part of the regular budget apparatus of the World Council. They realize that for the funds of the World Council and for the budgets of the churches contributed to all of this to be channeled into controversial grants would not be wise. And so all of those special fund grants, which are the ones that get the publicity, are from direct donations of member churches and people in the churches who say, I want my money to go for this. Interchurch Aid, Refugee and World Service is by far the largest part of the World Council. It's the part that handles all of the aid mechanisms, and it coordinates things when there's a typhoon in Bangladesh or a huge drought in the Sahel or something. It would be silly and harmful for the German Christians and the British Christians and the Danish Christians and the American Christians and the Canadian Christians all to take a boat and expect the local church to be able to distribute and deal with all those different instruments coming at them. So this is a coordinating mechanism for all that kind of effort around the world, and most of the churches of the world use that service. So most of the money that passes through the World Council, $30-40 million worth of money and goods, food, blankets, all that sort of stuff, go through that part of it. That doesn't mean it goes through Geneva. Much of it is kept in project funds in New York or London, and wherever it can be most easily collected and dispersed. the instrument for our relating to it is Church World Service of the National Council of Churches here, which is on the phone daily and puts out emergency requests for help in conjunction with interchurch aid appeals. The Christian Medical Commission deals with all the church's medical work. Part of our mission work in the church in the last 100 years has been medical. And we have hospitals that are church hospitals, doctors that are sent by our churches all over the world. The Christian Medical Commission tries to coordinate that and bring together the missionary, tries to bring together the present medical activity of the churches around the world to make an impact on medical policy. And it works very closely with the World Health Organization, which you can see from the World Council building 300 yards down the path. The Ecumenical Church Loan Fund is a relatively new thing that's set up to give small loans. The problem with the big development agencies like the International Monetary Fund is that they talk millions. Well, what about a person who wants a $1,500 loan in the Philippines to buy some candy and cigarettes to start a little tiny store? There's no way the big show can get to that level, but the churches are there. And so through the network of churches, little loans can be made, and the payback and the monitoring has been amazingly good, and that kind of activity is a fiscal part of what is in a church aid. The last one is education and renewal. This was the one I worked in. Education is an office of education that tries to coordinate church work in education, tries to help advise, for instance, the churches of Africa what to do as the new nations build up their school systems, taking over what was formerly church schools. And those are not easy decisions, or a lot of different activities in connection with the International Year of the Child. This old Sunday School Association joined the World Council, and it comes into this. There is a women's desk there that deals constantly with the women in church and society. Faith and Order and this unit in the last 7 years have done a major study on the community of women and men in the church. And they had a big report at Sheffield that went to the Central Committee and will be at the Assembly. Francis, my wife, will be reporting on that and discussing that this afternoon at whatever the hour is, if any of you are interested in more on that. It also has one on renewal in congregational life. The lay centers, the lay training centers around the world have a kind of representative there, and they work together. The youth programs of churches around the world, theological education is a subunit here, and there's a great biblical teacher named Hans-Rudy Weber who is in biblical studies and who goes around the world training teachers in Bible study methods that he has worked on in many, many different cultures. And he's finally put some of this in a book, which I don't have with me, something about methods of Bible study. So if any of you are interested in the kind of Bible study that's not just your denomination and not just U.S. style or English-speaking style, he has a rich experience all over the world. Well, that's longer than I meant to go, but
his name
is Hans Rudy, H-A-N-S hyphen R-U-E-D-I, Weber, W-E-B-E-R.
And where is that available in his material?
Through the publications, somewhere I have a yellow sheet. I don't guess I brought it, of where to order things. You can order them from any of the World Council, and they'll send them, or you can order them from the Friendship Press in the National Council in New York City. He came to Atlanta when we were there. When we came back from the World Council, we were in Atlanta for 4 years, and he came there for a session with Bible teachers for 5 days. And so we participated in that. It was a very, very stimulating kind of experience for us. At any rate, you can see from this, 110 staff people with all that stuff, it's impossible. There's no way it can really do what it would like to do. But it tries. And the member churches, through their representatives in the assembly and the central committee, understand those limitations. They are the bridge between what happens there and what happens in the member churches. And you can imagine what it would be like to be in one of those positions where you had to go and try to reflect your constituency in the decisions. And then when the vote went, representing all this variety of churches around the world, go back home and try to interpret it to people who didn't have that kind of experience. So it's that sort of continual confrontation and negotiation that goes on. Well, let me stop and see what questions you'd like to pursue. Yes.
Can you tell me why the reasoning that the Baptists and the Evangelicals have for not becoming a part of the World Council? I can sort of see why the Catholics perhaps would not, but I'm wondering.
Well, when it was in formation back from 1910 up till 1948, was a time when many of the roots of modern evangelicalism in the U.S. and Europe were breaking away, when so-called modernistic theology was coming in and so forth. And so the formative period did not find them involved. So that it would take an initiative, kind of, to get them involved. Actually, many of them are involved. The Lausanne Conference, when was it, back in the 70s, that met at Lausanne, down the lake from Geneva, included a huge number of delegates from evangelical churches all around the world. 70% of those delegates came from churches that were members of the World Council of Churches. So that the World Council of Churches includes a huge number of so-called evangelicals, but the organized groups of evangelical conservatives, the more conservative denominations in our country, Missouri Synod Lutherans, Christian Reformed Church, etc., and the Baptist Church picks up part of that. The Southern Baptist Church, I grew up down there where every other person you see is a Baptist, black or white. And they move into cooperation with difficulty because their heritage is congregational. They think that the reality of the church is just congregation. They don't quite know how to handle their own superstructure, their own organized associations and conventions. And so it's very difficult for them to make that kind of shift. But they do participate in many different parts of this. The Catholic Church, and one of the reports to this assembly is a report on from the Joint Working Group, which through the years is a top-level number of people from the Vatican and from the World Council who meet regularly. And this is a discouraging report, because these 7 or 8 years have been sort of backlash against the major thrust forward ecumenically in Vatican II, and with Pope John, and even with Pope Paul VI. And the present Pope is not from his background easily ecumenical in that sense. So that it's a discouraging report. If the Roman Catholics ever did come in, it would require a fundamental change in the whole nature of the thing, because they're so big. That sort of scares the member churches, because if you did reconstruct the whole ecumenical movement organization in the World Council with its history, with the Catholics in, it would be dominated probably by the Catholics. And if you talk to Maria Augusta or any of the other Catholics, they are a bit ambivalent, because their hierarchy sort of sometimes acts like our hierarchy in ways that aren't as sensitive to new movements and things as they would like. So that process is a slow process, both with evangelicals and with the Roman Catholics. The World Council does not claim to be the ecumenical movement. At times it sounds like it, inevitably, because they're sinners over there like we're sinners over here, you know. But basically its perception of itself is it's a part It's an organized expression of the larger ecumenical movement of this century, which is bringing the Lutherans together, which brought our Presbyterian churches back together, and so forth. Yes?
Is there cooperation in aid to refugees and medical and so forth with the Catholic Church?
Usually pretty good. The evangelical wing of the churches, if you can speak of it that way, includes things like World Vision and a number of things that aren't quite churches. But they're like the missionary societies of 19th century church development. When the churches started proliferating, then they set up all these societies, do-good societies in this country, for missions and for against alcohol, and you know, hundreds of them. So that the nature of the church is part of the question. Now, when it gets down to cooperation, it usually works a lot better underneath than on top. I told him the other day, we had a woman on our committee from Uganda, a great woman named Janet Wasanga. Her husband was a canon in the Anglican Church of Uganda. And she was mayor of her little town. Well, she was one of the Ugandan church's delegates to Uppsala, and was on our committee. And after one of these lengthy central committee meeting discussions of the relationship between the Vatican and the World Council, all this heavy kind of plowing through all the stuff, she stood up and she said, "Well, we are doing fine in Uganda. Says the Catholics and the Protestants don't have any problem and working together there," said, "we just hope you don't mess it up in Rome and Geneva." So that even intercommunion, there in many, many places around the world, when the Catholic Mass is said, Protestants participate, and vice versa, as Marie Augustine Neal has participated here. Now, officially, that's still not permitted. But everybody knows that the Spirit of the Lord is not handcuffed totally by the organized structures of the church. At the same time, you can't let the gap get too wide between the official places of doctrine and the practice of the people. That's why a statement like the one on baptism, Eucharist, and ministry is a pretty important step in that. The cooperation varies, of course. The big cooperation of Church World Service and Interchurch Aid and the Catholic Relief Agencies, it varies from place to place. In England right now, we've just come back from a six-month sabbatic leave in London, and I went over to visit Christian Aid, which is like our Church World Service. It's the cooperative instrument of the British Council of Churches for the churches of England to do their aid work together. And I was over there for a lunch meeting with two staff members I knew and wanted to talk to. Well, when I got there, they said, "We're going over to the Catholic Agency because Bishop Arns from Brazil is speaking over there." And so we walked over. It's three or four blocks away out in Brixton in London. And the new head of the Catholic Relief Agency there and the new head of the Christian Aid Agency are both younger staff members, both of them with a lot of vision, both of them thinking they're going to change the world quickly. So that the relationships in this country between the big Catholic aid societies and Church World Service are pretty good. Another one is the Lutheran, because the Lutheran churches have a big Lutheran World Federation. It's half as big in staff in Geneva as the World Council. Not always smoothly working. It's the only member church family group that's that powerful. The Anglicans have an Anglican, what do they call it? Anyway, they have a World Anglican Network that centers in the Archbishop of Canterbury, and they have regular meetings. The Reformed family has an association that our Presbyterian churches belong to, that includes about 60 or 70 million Presbyterian Reformed people around the world. But all they do is do some studies and so forth. They are the ones that met last year in Canada and threw out those two churches that are white churches that support apartheid in South Africa. They are Reformed churches. And they have just elected a colored South African, Alan Bosak, to be their new president for 4 years. he's going to be one of the major speakers, and it'll be interesting to watch the news on him. He's in a very tricky position, because if he says what he really thinks publicly at Vancouver, he'll break some laws in South Africa, because there are laws against speaking against your government in that country. Anyway, the Lutherans don't do it so modestly. They have a much larger kind of federation. They have some 3,000 people on the staff around the world administering aid programs. And this operates in a subtle way to offer an alternative to the World Council. The 70 or 80 million Lutherans around the world who gather in the Lutheran World Federation are all Lutherans. So it does not represent quite as much of the kind of jagged diversity that the World Council does, and it looks safer. So that they work together, the folks in education over there, Anza Lima and Herb Schaefer, some of you may know those folks. We were in and out of each other's meetings all the time, and they're in the same building, they cooperate, but the size of their establishment makes them, in ways, a parallel track from many of these activities. You didn't ask that question.
No, but that's interesting.
It is indeed. And it will continue to be interesting. Other questions?
The document, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry. This is, will this be studied at all at this at Vancouver, or is it something that will be going on for the next 10 years or so?
The official action taken by the last central committee last year was to send it to the churches for study and response. So it'll be reported at Vancouver, but it is not an item for decision there. It's part of the longer ongoing process. If you'd like to glance at it, the whole text is in that journal.
Do you have any suggestions for the use of this in the church and how it's best studied in the congregation?
I don't have the documents here. It probably talks about them in that article. There are two or three study guide helps, theological critiques, and it's set in a way to have a paragraph of the statement and then some backup type theological references, biblical references, and so forth, so that it's designed for a continuing process of discussion. And there'll be helps that will be coming out of your Lutheran headquarters, I would think. If they're not, then call them up, collect, and ask them why.
Okay. All right.
There is an 800 number they can call. It doesn't have to call collect.
Well, I say that half-jokingly, but only half-jokingly. The people in those offices in our boards, in my church and your churches, are overwhelmed with the traffic. And they have to spend a huge amount of energy explaining the last grant to Zimbabwe, or whatever it may be, rather than helping people who want to move ahead on these other parts of the World Church's agenda. And so if people from the local churches read some of this stuff and call them up and say, hey, how about some helps? It doesn't mean they have got to spend energy producing them. They're probably helps somewhere that aren't coming down the Lutheran track or the Presbyterian track in ways that make it easy to use them. And so some jogging from the grassroots is the way they get their agenda straightened out. They can then say, when they get criticized at the next meeting, oh, how come so and so and so, and say, well, we've had all these requests for something on the BEM statement, and we've been trying to work with that. You affect the agenda there, as ultimately you can affect the agenda of the World Council through that sort of interest too. Well, let's talk a little bit about the publicity and the grants and the CBS and the Reader's Digest. We were out of the country since January, so we heard those reported from afar. In preparation, knowing that that's where I come from, man, when I go home, if people say, didn't you have something to do with the World Council? I say, what the hell are they up to? Or worse. And they hear these programs, they read in their papers, nothing like the spread I've given you this morning, and nothing like the pleasant tone I've used. What they get is what the news thinks is newsworthy and controversial, and tilted in a certain way. Now I've got here the transcripts of the original interviews Molly Safer did with Philip Potter, only little tiny bits of which were used, and it's interesting which were used and in what framework. The background for the Reader's Digest articles, the responses of church leaders like your Lutheran leaders. And if any of you'd like to look at this in more detail, this is an inch thick pile of stuff that friends collected so I could have it. I've read through it quickly. There's one interesting article that some church news writer did, sort of like the Reader's Digest article, where he sort of uses what he thinks are the same tactic. He says, now Lillian Hellman lives in Pleasantville, New York. And as anybody know, Lillian Hellman was a member of Communist Front organizations in the 1940s. And you have to ask whether the Reader's Digest, which has its offices in Pleasantville, New York, has been affected by living near Lillian Hellman. And says, there's no evidence that they've ever had anything to do with each other, but they bound to bump into each other in the supermarkets, and who knows what kind of influence. So that sort of style, which is trying to get at the manipulation of the interpretation of what's going on, that's highly selective and for certain causes. There's also in one of these journals a review of a British book published last year that did a study of the so-called Muldergate scandal. You may remember that. Mulder was the head of information for the South African government, and he was exposed for spending millions of rand, South African rands, in supporting propaganda type things in all over the world favorable to South Africa. And that blew that government out of office in South Africa because there was no legal way he could do that. But some of the attacks on the World Council during that period were traced back to that money. And it's so this is an interesting kind of thing, and I'd be interested in your perceptions of it since you were here in the middle of it in a way that I was not. So I really would like to take a little while and explore that with you.
I guess one thing I've wondered is that usually a selective journalistic interpretation presupposes some kind of motive, and I don't know exactly what CBS, what would their motive have been? If indeed that was a slanted presentation for
shock
or something
value.
Just that
just
way.
Just shock value.
Well, what do you think?
Just sensationalism. Mm-hmm.
When I listened to the CBS, and it occurred to me that the reason for the attack it appears that when a group does not definitely come out with some kind of political or economic philosophy, they are open to anything that relates to doing something for people. And this, the CBS, it seems like they didn't open up that this is an organization for people, actually, not for an economy and not for a government or a type of government. But this doesn't come out, and I think it's so easy, it made it so easy for them to attack. Like one thing that comes to mind was Potter was, said, well, you quoted Marx. Well, of course, a lot of people quote Marx for all kinds of different reasons, not for communist reasons or political, but just because he has said something that is appropriate to a discussion. But these kinds of things, I think it is what makes the Assembly or the World Council of Churches so susceptible to these criticisms, that because they are not dealing with what these people, people want them to deal with. They want them to come out with firm, it seems like firm decisions about things that we have made, the press and the government makes the most important issues, and of course that's not the most important issue. The most important issue is people. And it seems to be so obvious, and yet it's so slippery. You can't really, tangle with this concept. It's very slippery. And I think it makes it very difficult for people, other people like ourselves, to explain it.
It really does. The documents here get into that question of motive a little bit. Without any high conspiracy reading of history, the establishment of the Institute on Religion and Democracy, is that the name of it, in Washington, has been interpreted as a major kind of right-wing supported attempt to undercut the mainline church's efforts to raise moral questions about political issues, and to confine those questions to the privatistic ones like prayer in the schools and so forth, rather than the international ones and the global ones. That agency is closely related to many of these attacks, and they are cited, Newhouse is quoted, and so forth. There are people who trace some of those people in that office back to the earlier South African games, but I don't, you know, it's a broader kind of thing than that. I think it's a fear of the churches becoming more politically aware of the implications for human beings of government and economic policy. So that as the churches move into this troubled area against a background when we didn't really have to do it in this country, the kind of shock of the German churches not doing any better with Hitler is sort of a shadow back behind us all. And we have ridden through those crisis periods in our country without an established church, but with a church, with a set of churches, with a capital C church that's very uneasy when it gets prophetically critical of the military-industrial complex type analysis that Eisenhower's term picked up. So that it's hard for the churches to know how to move well with all of their members in this. I think a second factor that's made the right wing move more in more organized ways to undercut it and to put out studies of this sort that result in programs like this is the move of the conservative evangelicals in social justice, the Sojourners and the Other Side and people like Ron Sider and people whose Christian faith has to be affirmed by evangelicals in a way that it takes a lot of doing for a person labeled with the World Council like me to be in small group meetings with people who are hostile before they begin to say, well, old Kennedy might really believe in Jesus, you know. Because I don't start off saying a lot of Jesus, Jesus, Jesus words, but my faith is evangelical. I grew up in that kind of faith. That's what I believe. But when the conservative evangelical social justice wing begins to become prominent in criticizing Falwell and the right-wing folks, then that really puts the pressure on those who want religion to, quote, stay out of politics, or when it is in politics, to be for those things in politics that do not raise fundamental questions about the type of political economic system we live under, or the commitment to militarism and other dangerous things to people all around the world. And it's that sort of tension period we are in right now. Now, from outside, from over there in London, seeing the difficulties through the British context and hearing about all this stuff over here, one of the questions I ask is, why does a little outfit like this get worth attacking? And I think it is because it has been able, through those controversial grants and through the raising up of racism, for instance, to become a voice for the Christian conscience of the world. Not that every Christian would agree with those methods, but it has focused attention on South Africa and apartheid, and it has kept it visible. And there would be a whole lot less pressure for divestment and for change, or even for the Namibian situation to be straightened out, if the World Council did not exist, if this voice did not come with all of these controversial news kinds of things. So the vested interests of profit-making activity in the U.S., in Germany, and the uproar that comes up occasionally in the U.S. is parallel and often overwhelmed by the uproar in Germany over the same kinds of things. The advantage over there is that they can send a group down there to Geneva and get quick communication, whereas the Atlantic Ocean sort of makes it look like way over there. From Germany, Geneva is not way over there, it's right here. So that the same powerful momentum, let me choose my words carefully, the same powerful momentum and inertia of what's called advanced industrial capitalism as our kind of political economy continues to move in the world more and more internationally with multinationals, the kind of thing Marie Augusta has been talking about this week. The underside of those advances become more and more hurtful to more and more people. And the church, which is grounded in all these people, is more sensitive to those hurts. So the church around the world, the churches around the world increasingly say, this doesn't square with what we believe God wants for human life. And so the churches in all kinds of places and in all kinds of ways are trying to say, does it have to be this way? Can't we do a better job with the land and with the resources of the world than to have plenty of food for people to eat and have people starving all the time? There must be a better way. Well, the people who are profiting from continuing the present games naturally don't volunteer to give up their power and their resources. And we it's not they, it's us. You know, we're part of that kind of establishment. That's why we eat well and drink well and are clothed well and sheltered well here in this country. So that as the Christian churches try to, and Christian people, try to struggle through to a clarity that will let their mission address these structural questions, these struggles surface in the Catholic Bishops' Conference in the U.S., in the Church of England's discussion on nuclear war, etc., etc., in liberation theology in the Latin American churches, and in the kind of ferment that's going on all over the world about what to do about these massive problems. The World Council, like the Catholic Synod of Bishops, which put out some very tough statements in the last decade, the evangelicals when they met at Lausanne, anytime you get a seriously representative group of Christians from around the world, these questions are going to be the agenda. Not the only agenda, and one of the reasons that the World Council assemblies and meetings often run Americans crazy is that they're lengthy. They set them up for 3 weeks, and busy Americans don't believe God can keep the show back home going while they're at a meeting for 3 weeks away from the office. You know, it's that sort of pace we get here. Well, why does it last 3 weeks? It's because they celebrate a lot. They explore new liturgies together. They try to become part of other people's Christian expression. They study the Bible in small groups like this for not just a session when somebody lectures, but 10 meetings during a 3-week period with people from all over the world. And all of a sudden you realize that the angle of vision you had on Scripture is not the angle of vision of this person from a Pacific island. And so that kind of interchange is all built into the rhythm of an assembly along with all these hot issues. Now the press is never going to report that groups studied the Bible and that there were all these celebratory worship events and stuff, or times to get together. The press is going to report the ones that sell papers and get advertisers to watch 60 Minutes, to pay for people watching 60 Minutes, so that we're caught in that kind of tension. I, for one, think this is a great time to be a Christian, because these are the fundamental questions of Christian history, and they are coming at us like lightning bolts. There isn't much way we can avoid them. But there's not much certainty or clarity that we know how to deal with them very well, and the World Council is part of that effort. Well, it's almost time for lunch. Or the other question, I didn't mean for that to be that much of a sermon. I'm sorry.
Just one little question. Is it my understanding that Plowshares is not a part of the World Council of Churches? And they are not, are you going to report at the World Council of Churches? It's completely independent.
There are 5 or 6 Plowshares named groups around the U.S. that I'm vaguely familiar with. One of them will have a coffee house at Vancouver. I don't know anything about them. It has nothing to do with the little group we are. What we are is just a little group doing some programs in education. And we've been the ones with you this week.
Oh, okay.
So, well, thanks for coming.